to, and that is Integrated Genomics versus Tillman Gerngross. Gerngross or Gerngross? Well, I'll know in a minute.
Now we'll see whether you watched when he was put.
Good morning. My name's Mary Ann Holzhall, and I represent Integrated Genomics. I may refer to it during the argument as IG because that's the way we're used to referring to it. And the defendant, appellee, is Dr. Tillman Gerngross. IG filed suit against Dr. Gerngross for breach of contract and fraudulent misrepresentation in his acquisition of genomic data that had been developed by Integrated Genomics and was offered for license to universities, to government researchers, to commercial entities. The issue here is whether the district court erred following trial, finding that although Dr. Gerngross had made misrepresentations in his acquisition of the data, those misrepresentations were not material. The second issue is whether the trial court erred as a matter of law, entering summary judgment earlier in Dr. Gerngross's favor on the breach of contract claim.
Now, Integrated, all right, IG, did not require Dr. Gerngross to sign the standard contract.
That is correct.
Yeah. Doesn't that alone support Judge Kennelly's finding that his failure to disclose his commercial affiliation with GlycoFi wasn't material?
No, it was not, because at no time the trial court did not find that, and there was no evidence that Dr. Gerngross had told Dr. Nikolsky, the IG employee with whom he was negotiating, why he could not sign the standard contract. At trial, he testified that some of the provisions were too rich, but he couldn't really further articulate why he did not sign it, nor did he say whether he told Dr. Nikolsky that. So their negotiations continued on an oral basis until Dr. Gerngross had sent Dr. Nikolsky the letter agreement of April 2002 in which he agreed to the restrictions by his research group at Dartmouth.
What are we to make of the fact that, was it, I think, 2003, IG sent the updated information for free with no new restrictions?
That's correct. That transaction was handled by Dr. Campbell. Dr. Campbell did testify at trial. He had not heard of Dr. Gerngross before he entered the business development area in the spring of 2003. It wasn't until well later that he even learned that Dr. Gerngross was affiliated with Gerngross's startup company, GlycoFi.
By that time, though, Gerngross had already made his presentation to IG with the slides and so on showing that affiliation, right?
He had shown that.
So IG at that point knew that Dr. Gerngross was affiliated with this commercial operation, right?
Correct.
And after that happened, it sent the updated information for free with no new restrictions, correct?
That's correct.
And why doesn't that help support Judge Kennelly's position?
Because the simple fact that Dr. Gerngross was affiliated with GlycoFi, as well as being a professor at Dartmouth, was not unusual. There were many instances, there were examples of that at trial, where you have a professor who consults with an outside company, maybe a CSO of an outside company. But in each of those cases, the individual, the professor, is very careful about maintaining a distinction between his academic affairs and his commercial activities.
But isn't that because they've been forced to sign the standard contract for academics?
No, that is before any negotiation takes place. There are examples of pharmaceutical companies saying, we have a PhD student, she'll be doing academic research, can we have a license? Well, you can have an academic license, but you have to take these restrictions. If this research pans out, you have to take a commercial license. There are example of a professor who may have consulting obligations with a couple of different companies. He has his academic license for his academic activities. He has another license to work, to do his work with Company A, and a third commercial license to do his work with Company B. When Dr. Campbell sent out the update in 2003, he looked. He couldn't find a file. But as far as he knew, he was dealing with Tilman Gerngross of Dartmouth College, not of Glycophy. During this time also, Dr. Gerngross didn't call and say, I'm from Glycophy. It was still from Dartmouth College. Dr. Campbell didn't attend the PowerPoint presentation, and we're not really sure who from IG did. In his view, he was just completing the transaction that had been struck, the deal that had been struck a year earlier in 2002. It wasn't uncommon to send updates as they became available at no charge. He viewed it as a continuation of the agreement, and as did Dr. Gerngross. He, at trial, testified that he considered the same restrictions that he had agreed to in 2002 to apply to the update as well.
What about the testimony that the company was in dire straits financially at the time of the purchase? Wouldn't that support the inference that the company would have been happy to take $5,000 for the sequence, even had it realized that Dr. Gerngross wasn't seeking the data for academic purposes?
In fact, I think it supports the opposite. That sequence was worth quite a bit of money. IG considered it a key asset. 1,000 man-hours of work had gone into it. It was negotiating for similar sequences in the high six figures, and it actually, for similar sequences, similar organisms, executed contracts. It had negotiated contracts demanding high six figures, low seven figures for this particular sequence.
Did any of those actually close?
Not for the Pekia sequence, not at that time frame. Later on, there were commercial licenses in which there were varying structures. It might be a flat fee. It might be a royalty. But during that time period, yes, IG was in severe financial straits, but it would not budge on the price. That's shown by those negotiations that did not close with other companies that did not close on the Pekia data, because IG was not willing to cut its to have a fire sale. As an analogy,
do you agree that your burden here was to convince the district judge by clear and convincing evidence that the omitted information was material?
That's correct. That's correct, and we believe we did. There was nothing to the contrary. Nobody said we would have sold it for peanuts. And they were in dire financial straits. If you have a $1 million house and you have, say, a $200,000 obligation for payroll, are you going to sell your house for $5,000? It may not have been, mid seven figures, but they weren't going to give it away for peanuts if it were a commercial license. And in fact, the trial court, this is where the trial court had an inconsistency in its findings of fact. It found that, yes, he did make misrepresentations, that any reasonable person in Integrated Genomics shoes would believe that Dr. Gerngross was an academic, and found that as a general rule, Integrated Genomics charged commercial customers several times more than it would an academic customer. And yet, there's no explanation aside from inference or speculation, is it conceivable that they wouldn't have charged more? I don't think that's what clear and convincing evidence is. Clear and convincing is high probability. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt.
Ms. Holtzall, let me ask. You're saying that the district court found that Dr. Gerngross fraudulently concealed information. Is that right?
Correct.
I thought the district judge just said, in essence, you've got a good argument on that point, but I'm going to go on to consider this question of materiality.
There was some ambiguity in the opinion there.
A solid argument can be made.
Earlier in the findings of fact, or the section denominated findings of fact, the court does say That said, the court finds that Gerngross did not disclose to Integrated Genomics his affiliation with Glycophy or his intended commercial use of the P. capillaris data. Rather, his dealings left Integrated Genomics personnel and would have left any reasonable person in their position with the belief that Gerngross was dealing with Integrated Genomics as an academic. That's in the findings of fact and conclusions blot, page 4. Applying the test of materiality, that is, would the plaintiff had acted differently if it had known the true facts, the court has to ask.
You're into your rebuttal, ma'am. Just, I thought I'd let you know.
I'm sorry?
You're into your rebuttal. I mean, I thought I'd call your attention to that.
Thank you. In that case, I'll hear from Mr. Boudet.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Michael Boudet representing the appellee, Dr. Tilman Gerngross. Your Honors, I'd like to start by clarifying the record on a couple of questions that were already asked by the court. Regarding the shipment of the supplemental data in May 2003, Integrated Genomics unquestionably knew at that point that Dr. Gerngross, my client, was affiliated with a commercial company and was using the data in a commercial effort, because he had gone in January 2003 here to Chicago to IG's executive offices and presented to its CEO and its head of sales all about that research and all about his dual role. Ms. Holzhall said, we're not sure who did attend. On the contrary, Dr. Kogan, who was head of sales as of January 2003, and you'll note in this case there's a rapid turnover in terms of who is head of sales at IG, but at that time it was Dr. Kogan. He not only was there, but he testified in his deposition, which was his trial testimony, that he recalled some of the slides. Dr. Fonstein said he believed, who was the CEO of Integrated Genomics, testified he was there, but he may have been looking through some other papers at the time. So we know that the CEO and the head of sales were there at the presentation. And the shipment of the supplemental data, with no questions asked, with no additional restrictions, in May 2003, absolutely goes directly to the hard materiality in this case. The only excuse we can hear from IG is that Dr. Campbell didn't know. Well, this goes to the corporate knowledge of IG, not to Dr. Campbell's individual knowledge. And I would also suggest that what he did know was that he had gone back to the file to look for a file regarding this transaction and found nothing, no restrictions. Then he ships the supplemental data. So that does directly support the district court's ruling.
Even if IG was in a tough situation financially at the time of the sale to Dr. Gerngross, can we really discount the possibility that it would have demanded something more for the sequence, if not six or seven figures, had it known of his commercial aspirations?
I don't think we can completely discount the possibility, Your Honor. That's a fair question. But on the other hand, that's not the issue before this appellate court now, in that the district court made a finding of non-materiality. The burden on IG at the court below was clear and convincing evidence, not just a possibility. And here on appeal, of course, we're deferring to the bench trial result. So I'd suggest there's sort of a double elevated standard of review. But, Your Honor, let me just address your question because it's a fair one on the facts. The testimony about the key asset of the company and the 1,000 man hours and the million-dollar house, that sort of stuff, was from IG's trial witness, the live trial witness, Dr. Campbell. He had nothing to do with this transaction, nothing. The gentleman who negotiated it in 2002 was the two prior head of sales, Dr. Nikolsky. We asked him about the price of $5,000 and how was that arrived at. And he said, well, I don't remember too much about the discussion, but this price doesn't surprise me at all. Why is that, Dr. Nikolsky? Because this was an off-the-shelf item. Work had already been done. We could sell multiple copies. The only incremental cost was the cost of the disk that the data was downloaded onto. So $5,000 was a perfectly reasonable price. That was the testimony of the gentleman who negotiated the deal. So we then asked him, you know, both sides, frankly, would you have charged more? And he said, I really don't know. I couldn't begin to tell you. Way too speculative. Then he was asked, knowing what you know now, At that point, having, of course, been informed that Dr. Gerngross was, in fact, at a commercial company, having seen the press release describing that company, et cetera, during his deposition. Knowing what you know now, would you have treated him as an academic customer? His answer was yes, I would. So I think if you look at the record, Your Honor, there's several different bases for the court's materiality finding or non-materiality finding, and any one of them would be sufficient to bolster the district court's ruling given the standard of review. I think it's also important to point out, Your Honors, going to the initial question of the fraudulent omission or fraudulent concealment, the district court found that Dr. Gerngross didn't affirmatively tell IG about his dual role until in the initial conversations. But it didn't find that was a fraudulent concealment. It just said an argument could be made.
Was there any finding of fraudulent intent on his part in that omission?
No. No, Your Honor. And I certainly would suggest that his going to IG and broadcasting in a PowerPoint all about this would be somewhat inconsistent with a fraudulent intent before asking for the supplemental data. One repeated flaw factually in IG's argument is they keep saying in both of their briefs that Dr. Gerngross gave the data to GlycoFi instead of using it academically at Dartmouth. The data was used academically at Dartmouth, beginning in April of 2003 and for the following 9 months until December. And then even afterwards, there were publications that were academic publications. If you'd like to see an excerpt of the data, Your Honors, I'd suggest at TJA 198, you can see a fragment of the data published in an academic publication, the always edifying Yeast Magazine, which is a peer-reviewed publication. And you can see the G, A's, T's, and C's that constitute the sequence. And that we asked IG's witnesses, Dr. Nikolsky, Dr. Campbell, is this academic use? The answer was yes. So it was used academically. And that's important because I think that, obviously, they would have a stronger fraud by omission claim if he says, hello, I'm a professor at Dartmouth. Then it's never used at Dartmouth. It's only used at the private company, GlycoFi. That would be a better fraudulent omission claim.
Was IG snookered in any way to your thinking?
Your Honor, no, because I'd say the most devastating finding to them is the last page of Judge Cannelli's opinion after trial. The last page says the evidence is that they never asked. And that goes directly to the heart of materiality, reliance, and fraudulent omission in the first place.
If you never ask, you can't be snookered.
Well, no, I wouldn't go that far, Your Honor. I contrast it, for instance, with the W.R. Grace decision, which goes back to the 1980s, but both parties have discussed it. There, a party made an affirmative representation about certain natural gas fields, and then circumstances changed before closing, and the court held they had a duty to come forward and correct the prior rep and warranty, effectively. I would contrast this with that situation.
So your view is that there would be no way that Judge Cannelli could have gone the other way and found materiality?
Not on the evidence, Your Honor. In every case, for instance, we might look at the Brown versus Broadway Perryville lumber case. In fraud cases, typically somebody at the plaintiffs takes the stand and says, had I known of X, I never would have done this transaction causation, or I would have charged more or paid less or what have you, loss causation. There was no witness at IG who said that. There was nobody. So there was actually, I would say, no affirmative evidence on which to base materiality or transaction or loss causation. If I could spend a couple of minutes on the publication argument.
You have done.
Three quick points. First, it's critical that the standard agreement, and Judge, you already pointed to this in your first question to my opponent, the standard agreement has a provision governing commercial use and a provision governing publication. The former was rejected, the latter was accepted. And I think that's critical to construing what the term publication means. Essentially, what's going on here is they're trying to resurrect the rejected provision by creative lawyering and construction of the term publication and the accepted provision.
Do we have the text of that agreement in the record?
It was never in the record, Your Honor.
So we just have recollections about what was in it?
We have Dr. Nikolsky's testimony about the standard terms. Strangely, it was not in the record. Second, and I'll make this very quick, There actually is no conflict. To the extent we're ever going to get to parole evidence, there is no conflict about the meaning of the term. Dr. Nikolsky, the gentleman for IG who negotiated this letter agreement, said it means making it available to everybody. Dr. Gerngross said it means putting it in the public domain. There's no conflict between that testimony and the sites they give for a supposed conflict, if you look at the record, Your Honors, just simply do not support it. And third, it's important to look at the actual language. He says in the letter agreement, my research group at Dartmouth College is restricted to the publication of no more than 10 kilobases of sequencing data from the Pikia genome per calendar year. And again, TGA 199 has an example of a publication of less than 10 kilobases of excerpts of the data. This is a letter between two scientists talking about publication, with an exception for certain disclosures of fragments, followed by a sentence saying that it's void, the restriction, if the data becomes available from a public domain at no charge. I suggest that the letter itself, as always, is the starting point for the meaning of the terms, and suggests clearly that what they are talking about is publication in the normal sense, not in any legal or artificial sense. The evidence of what happened here, Your Honors, is that the data was used solely by his research group at Dartmouth College for most of 2002 after the purchase. December of 2002, I believe I might have said 2003 before. I'm correcting myself now. In December of 2002, some of that research team went and became employees of GlycoFi. And Dr. Gerngross doesn't know for certain, but he presumes, and he said this in discovery, he presumes the data may have gone on computers that went with those folks over to GlycoFi. We might call that a transfer of the data. We might call that a disclosure. We might call it a communication. We might call it a failure to keep the information confidential within the confines of Dartmouth College. We might call it a commercial use. The problem with IG's contract case is that none of those things were ever promised between the parties. The only promise was not for the team not to publish more than 10 kilobases per calendar year. And I would suggest that there's no plain meaning construction or construction supported by the dictionaries or, frankly, any case that could stretch the term that far, especially in light of the rejection and the meeting of the minds on the rejection of a restriction on commercial use. Thank you.
How many minutes?
I'd just like to address a few points that Mr. Boudet made. He spoke of the PowerPoint presentation that Dr. Gerngross gave at IG. It had the GlycoFi logo on it. Right across the page, on each page, was the Dartmouth logo. There's no evidence of what he told IG about what GlycoFi was using the data for as opposed to what Dartmouth was. In fact, Mr. Boudet just told you that, well, it was being used by Dartmouth all through 2002. So in January 2003, what could GlycoFi have been using the data for? That Dr. Gerngross could have said, IG, yes, this is what GlycoFi is doing. He drew your attention to certain publications, academic publications. If you take a look at each one of those, the authors are listed. There are GlycoFi authors listed. Dr. Gerngross's name is always identified with Dartmouth College and only Dartmouth College. He's not listed as Dartmouth College and GlycoFi. Here's his contact information at the Thayer School of Engineering. Dr. Campbell said he did review some of those publications during the time frame that he was dealing with Dr. Gerngross. Yes, he may have seen them, and yes, there he was, Dr. Gerngross, Dartmouth College. With respect to Dr. Nikolsky's testimony, during his deposition, he was shown those same articles. And as Mr. Boudet said, would you consider Dr. Gerngross an academic customer? Yes. There was no evidence that Dr. Nikolsky knew the depth of his involvement with GlycoFi or what GlycoFi had done with IG's data when he said, he's an academic customer, I don't know if he lied to me. Finally, with respect to the publication, Mr. Boudet said there may have been a transfer, there may have been a communication. There's no indication that these transfers or communications were made to Glycophy or to anyone downstream from Glycophy with any sort of restrictions on publication or disclosure of the data. That does leave a big question as to whether that contract has been breached.
Is this data still confidential from your perspective?
There has been. It's still sold. There have been portions of the sequence published, but it's, I think, 9 million kilobases. It's a very large sequence. KB limitation was a very, very small portion of it. And it is still, IG is still one of the only sources for the information. There may have been another source available as of May 2009. If you have no more questions, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. Mr. Boudet, you came to us from the First Circuit. We should have brought you up here in the first case to tell us how Romero is working out. Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement, and thank you.